Thank you again, by the way, for being flexible with this. I know we moved initially, so I appreciate that.
Oh my God, Matthew Cappucci, don't even worry about it. You know, I mean, we're flexible, we're live. How Italian are you, by the way? Like, I mean, the parents both full Italian?
Oh, no. My mother's maiden name is Doherty, so we are very much Irish. I'm about as Italian as the Olive Garden.
You're the Olive Garden of Italian. Okay, so you guys weren't having the Sunday sauce, the you weren't growing up with lasagna. No, you guys were doing the soda bread and, you know, heading to Ireland.
I love my family dearly, but I don't come from a long line of cooks. I come from a long line of preheaters, microwavers, you know.
So they're excellent with using the microwave. They're like, you know, no problem.
Yes, they're adept at defrosting.
Okay, but no big family dinners. Okay, Matthew Cappucci. All right, well, look, this is a treat. You're probably like one of the newest members to Fox 5. And, you know, it's kind of interesting because a lot of times when new talent are hired, a lot of people don't know them. They're coming from outside the area. But you actually had a pretty big, you still do, a big following from WAMU, which is the NPR radio affiliate here in D.C., right?
Yep. So it was all strategy. I always wanted to move to D.C. Actually, I came down here when I was 14 for a weather camp, which, believe it or not, is a real thing. And I loved it so much. I kept the same Metro card ever since, and I said I have to live here someday. And so when I graduated, I had always wanted to do TV weather. But, I mean, let's be honest, if I go out to the middle of a very rural area, they don't pay all that well. And I'd much rather live in a place like D.C. because, I mean, look around. The people here are incredible. And so I figured if I went to the Washington Post, I could do local radio, NPR, try to build a following there, do enough through social media, that eventually I could convince one of the local stations to bring me on board. And that's exactly what happened. I said to myself, it needs to happen by the time I turn 24. And I made it with less than 2 months to spare. So dude, I have a plan for everything. These little five-year plans, but they always seem to work out.
Okay, have you thought about writing a book on manifestation? Because
there's a book coming out in... Oh, I don't know if I emailed you about this, but yeah, there's a book coming out on August 2nd. It's called Looking Up.
Okay, well, I had read that you were writing a book, but wait a minute, is the book about like how to go for your dreams? What's the book about?
So it's called Looking Up. It's very upbeat, very inspirational. It's a little bit of everything in that you'll learn some weather, you'll really be brought along vicariously on all my adventures, whether it be the time I, you know, lost part of my door in a tornado or beat my truck to heck with softball-sized hail or was in a hurricane shelter in Florida that reminded me a bit of Walmart or all these crazy, silly things that culminate really nicely into a career journey, but also takes you through the process of like me always wanting to be a TV meteorologist in Washington, D.C., and then all of a sudden getting the call from Paul, the news director, and you know, kind of like that end scene in Willy Wonka and Chocolate Factory where Charlie gets everything he ever wanted. And that day I felt like I was in a walk evader just going up to outer space.
You have truly manifested everything that you have started out to do, like from a very young age, because I actually read, right? You had saved up money. You bought a camera, like an old school, you know, handheld. I mean, you're very young. So it was like probably maybe it was even on your. No, I guess it wasn't on your iPhone. You saved up for a real camera.
Oh, this was back in 2005. I got a real camcorder. It was, I think, like 20 times zoom. Back then, it was like $300, $400. It was the pinnacle of technology. It was about this big. It was huge. And in reality, nowadays, you can do the same thing with an iPhone.
Right.
But yeah, I'd ride around the neighborhood on a metal bicycle during thunderstorms and try to storm chase. And growing up in Massachusetts, you didn't really have many storms to actually chase. I tried to take videos of lightning, and the footage fell tragically short of National Geographic quality. But it kind of was a start. And I looked back at the videos the other day. In fact, I sent one to my elementary school principal about a half hour ago. And we were kind of reminiscing over what was and what now is.
So, okay, Matthew, obviously from a young age, you have this passion for weather, right? Now, that's an interesting passion. You know, most people want to be, I don't know, famous, an actor, a firefighter. So, okay, did people pick on you for this, you know, because people equate loving the weather with being a nerd or whatever. And I mean, you obviously loved it from the beginning. So tell me what your childhood was like. Was it rough?
My childhood was great in that I never really paid much attention to the other kids. Like, honest to God, in elementary school, my best friends were the ladies in the front office. And every morning I'd walk in, see Mrs. Finley, Mrs. Mosca, Mrs. Adragna. We'd talk about our days for like 15 minutes every morning, second, third grade. We'd have like full-grown adult conversations. And Mrs. Mosca had a jelly bean container on her desk, and every day she'd let me turn the thing and get a couple jelly beans. Middle school, similar story. The administration I loved. The teachers I was very close to. The other students, because let's be honest, the kids in those days were, you know, being rude to teachers, playing with silly bands, Pokemon cards, whatever the kids did. And I was buried in textbooks all the time, or sewing a green screen in my basement, or doing all these things that precipitated in what I do nowadays. And so I never really cared much about what the other kids thought.
Wow.
Which it did get a little bit lonesome after a while. But then in high school, I went to a place. It was a charter school in Massachusetts called Sturgis. And they called it the Island of Misfits. And there was a good reason why, in that everyone there, whether it be a student, whether it be a teacher, came from a place where they didn't really belong. They might be academically gifted. They might be on individual education plans. It might be anywhere in between. But they all came from backgrounds where, for some reason or another, they didn't belong. And by virtue of no one belonging, suddenly everyone belonged. You never had any bullying. You these people, and I'm not exaggerating when I say any of these kids I could still be best friends with today. I adored every last student. We had 100 kids per grade. The teachers were incredibly eclectic. Like, you think I'm nerdy. The teachers were, too. And there was a sense of solace to be derived from suddenly being in an environment where anybody could be their nerdy selves, and it worked. And This school was beyond quirky. Like, we didn't have a cafeteria because the school building was too poor to have a cafeteria. So they just let us out on the street for lunch. Or we didn't have a gymnasium or an auditorium, so we'd have to do yoga in the hallways. Or whenever it rained, we'd have cups that we'd go outside and place beneath certain parts of the hallway to catch the water. On one winter break, somebody left bananas in the school, and so we got a fruit fly infestation. So they poured vinegar all in all these cups all around the school that were toppling onto kids as they walked down the hallway. Like, it was a bizarre school, actually a converted furniture store that they just put up a couple walls in and called a school.
Okay, wait a minute. Who had the foresight to get you into this school? Was this your parents, or were you going to your parents and going, I don't want to go to, you know, public high school or a traditional private high school? How did that come about? Because that seems like the perfect fit for you, and like, it all worked. You know what I mean? Like, you, it seems like you avoided maybe the bullying that would have happened for a lot of kids.
To an extent. I mean, in middle school, I felt like middle school, I got out what I put in that I grew up in Plymouth, Massachusetts, decent area. You know, the educators were phenomenal. But the kids, as we progressed over time, I mean, I got in a couple fights in sixth grade, seventh grade. The kids weren't overly nice. I had a small group of kids who were academically driven. They challenged each other. But it was taught in an environment where if one kid didn't want to learn, they disrupt the entire class and you kind of be back at square one. And so I think by seventh, eighth grade, my parents knew I needed to go someplace else. I just needed to get to a place where I could thrive. And this school was actually the number one school in Massachusetts. And it was a public school, charter school. It was an international baccalaureate for all school, the only one in the country, meaning you don't have to test into this program. IB is kind of like AP.
Okay.
You never had to test in. You could just do it no matter what your background was. And your teachers would help you power through this program, which was an incredibly academically rigorous program. And it was just unlike any school I've ever seen or heard of before. And to this day, I don't think there are any other models like it. It was a school held together by duct tape and Band-Aids. And yet we never cared about walls, windows, a building. It was all about finding world-class educators who would do anything for students.
Well,
I mean, my math teacher would come in on the weekends to teach students. We'd meet at cafes to do some extra learning. I want to try gardening at one point. So my math teacher wanders into my history class and hands me a thing of seeds and just walks out. I mean, it was a very quirky school. And
it sounds like they let you be you, right? They let kids be them and find themselves, which is pretty hard to do if you're in a regimented traditional school. Okay, but we also learned, have you ever shared with your audience that you've been in a fight before? I mean, Matthew Cappucci in a fight, did you win? Or are we one and one? Did we win one? Did we lose one?
There were actually five individual episodes of it.
And what? Five
believe
rounds?
It or not, it's kind of funny. So I'll tell that story after. So there were like five or six kids who've been bullying me since kindergarten, first grade. I remember being like art class, my first grade year, we were drawing a mural, and this kid, Patrick, I won't say his last name, came over and just scribbled green all over what I had drawn.
Yeah.
Of course, this was first grade, but it just grew time and time again. And you know, gym class in sixth grade, seventh grade just becomes a recipe for not great things. But I actually looked them up a couple of weeks ago to see what became of them. And, you know, it's kind of exactly what you'd expect. you know, back in high school. So this was good.
So what, they're living outside of Plymouth, you know, doing a, you know, probably a decent job, but you know, I mean, not even decent job.
So one actually works in a cemetery digging holes for, and not to disparage anyone who does that. Like, wow, that's all fine and well, but just, you know, that's kind of the epilogue. So yeah. What is that song? Someday I'll be living in a big old city and it'll be, I forget who sings it. Not Katy Perry. I don't know. You know the song.
Well, thank God you lived through that. And yeah, bullies, they usually, you know, it's like, I don't know, history repeats itself. They're doing the same thing over and over and over again.
Well, the best part, you might appreciate this story. So back in like sophomore, junior year of high school, I used to do a lot of tutoring on the side. I'd work 40 hours a week while in high school to save for future college, future kids, future all that stuff. And I worked with...
You're an old soul. Future kids? Oh my God, Matthew, I have so much to ask you. Okay. Look at you. You're 24. You're planning for your children?
Oh, absolutely. I want them to be named after weather-themed things. Haley, Aurora, and Rain.
Oh my God.
I have a couple hoops to jump through first.
You're hysterical. Okay, keep going.
But so in high school, I used to do a lot of tutoring. And there was one kid who, my buddy Chris Newman said to me, hey, I have a friend from Plymouth who need some tutoring in pre-calc, but I can't do pre-calc. Can you do it? I was like, sure. So it was like February of my junior year. He gives me the address. I arranged with the parents, didn't look at the last name. And I drive over. It's like 6-7 o'clock at night, so it's dark. And I knock on the front door, and the father opens the door. And you have like two big Rottweilers barking. Your father's super tall. And there's like, you know, little old me in my blue jacket with a clipboard like, hey, I'm ready to teach your kids some math. And you just hear screaming in the background, and the father says, what's your hourly rate? I said, 40. He writes me a check for $40 and says, this isn't going to work out, and slams the door. And I'm like, what the heck? So I knock again. He's like, yeah, my kid said, no, he's given up. He's going to drop out. Thank you for your time. You can be on your way. And like literally slams the door in my face. So I'm like, what do I do? So I start driving down the road, and about 5-ish minutes later, my conscience got the better of me. And I turned back around and I wandered back to this house and I knocked on the front door and I said, I'm not going to leave until your son gives me 30 minutes of his time, because I didn't know this kid. I said, he's not going to drop out. If there is any chance he'll give me 30 minutes, we're going to get him through what he needs to pass this test to graduate. And turns out the dad was a state police officer. Like I had no idea. And so the kid had apparently barricaded himself into his bedroom. So the guy goes up the stairs. These dogs are now pouncing on me as I'm standing at the foot of the stairs near the front door. And
that would have deterred me there. Keep going.
It got worse. It sounds like a TV show. Like you just hear blue, bloody murder, screaming profanities as the father is banging on the door, which the kid has now blockaded with bookcases. And he beckons for me to come up the stairs. And you just hear like splintering wood. The father literally charged the door in, knocks down this bookshelf, calls up for me to like literally wander up the stairs into this random kid's bedroom. And he says, you know, Ian, you have a visitor. So I walk in. It's the kid who bullied me through 5th grade, 6th grade, 7th grade, 8th grade, who I haven't seen in years, who's now like a foot and a half taller than me, probably 50 or 60 pounds heavier, is now a high school wrestler. And without missing a beat, I'm like, hi, good to see you. Didn't think we'd wind up like this. Anyway, no hard feelings. I want to see you graduate. You owe it to yourself. I'm not leaving until you come down the stairs and give me 30 minutes. He gave me 2 hours and we met every day for about 3 weeks and he graduated.
Oh my God. Okay, wait, did you guys like keep a friendship? That's crazy. Is this in your book? This is like a movie.
I'll probably add that.
You didn't really develop a friendship, but you helped Ian, even though Ian had been. Did Ian say anything to you like, hey man, sorry for bullying you, thanks? Or Ian was still an a-hole?
I think at that point, it was almost an unfortunate power dynamic in that like he needed me to graduate. Right. And I didn't want to make him feel worse than he already did because like, I mean, it's a pretty humbling experience. And when I teach, like I'm a very serious educator. All I want to do is build people up, build up their confidence. And that's kind of what I do when I'm on air as well. Like I use words that no other TV meteorologist, even at our station, uses. Like you don't go on the air and say things like gravity wave, geostrophic, anticyclonic. And you couldn't get away with that in any other city in the country. But DC is a very smart area. And
smart audience.
Paul and Kyle give me an incredible amount of leeway because really I want people to learn. People don't watch local news for weather these days. If they can get it off their iPhone, they want either to be educated, informed, or inspired. And so I want these little teachable moments to just edify people a little bit. We're the only scientists that people get to interact with on a daily basis. And so might as well take that and run with it. I want people to learn.
That was one of my questions to you, is how do you think meteorology as a profession, or as, you know, as a teaching and scientific, you know, occupation, how do you think it's going to exist in the future with people that have iPhones? And, you know, you have this beautiful passion, but most people don't care. They just want to know what to wear. I mean, what, you know, what do you, how do you think your job is going to exist in 15 years?
As it exists now, no, which is, to be honest, why I do so many different things. I don't know necessarily what will come next, whether it be, you know, let's face it, there won't be a look. I'm too young to have a 40-year career in broadcast meteorology. Sue has ridden the wave.
Oh, yes. Our girl, Sue Pelka. Amazing. Yeah.
Amazing. And they will reach the finish line of TV when that happens. I'm 24. I just turned 24. I can't expect a 40-year career in TV, no matter how good I am. And so I have to be either more or different, and I have to be versatile to adapt to different platforms, whether that be growing and nurturing a social media audience, but also writing for the Washington Post, working for radio, working for an app in Florida. I kind of need to be everywhere so that whatever becomes next, I'm kind of dominant on that. But I think that you kind of mentioned a moment ago that most people just want to know what to wear. I think that's true to an extent, but I can't expect everybody to be passionate about the weather. But if you find someone who passionate about something, whatever it is, and that passion is contagious, it's enough to lure people in. And you get a human connection in a way that's really tough to nowadays, even on TV. I think during the pandemic, people were so fed up with watching TV news and just kind of seeing, you know, talking heads and seeing people that looked distant, that now they feed off human connection. And that's one of the strong suits of Fox 5. I mean, we are a weird channel. We do things that are, you know, let's face it, our competition would never in a million years do. And I think that endears us to the audience. And that's why of every place I could have landed, I'm beyond grateful to be at a place that is honestly as quirky and eclectic as I am. I fit right in here. But I think that by sharing that passion, which is insatiable, it makes people pause and watch. And even if they learn one new thing, that's a job.
I mean, you have that. You definitely are. I mean, no matter anything that you were talking about, because I just didn't realize how positive you are. I mean, you can see that it is infectious. Okay. Thanks. Well, we'll talk more about that. But tell me this, you went to Harvard? I mean, that's an interesting, okay, so you go to Harvard. I cannot imagine many people go to Harvard to be a meteorologist, but am I wrong?
You're entirely correct. So I never wanted to go to Harvard.
I love this.
You know, I want to go to a tiny school in Vermont called Linden State, which good school for meteorology, but a 99.4% acceptance rate. So kind of everyone gets in. Okay. Takes about 6 years to get a degree there, even though it's only a 4-year degree. So the stats weren't really in its favor. And I knew that the way TV meteorology was going, I needed a backup plan. And there's no better backup plan than a degree from Harvard. The question was, what would I get my degree in? They had a physics program. They had an environmental science program. I wanted a pure atmospheric sciences program. Now, Cornell looked to be a great option, Ivy League school, you know, decently rigorous, good degree, but it would be extremely expensive, like $35,000 a year. Harvard only wanted to charge $8,000. And so, because I have great financial aid. So I applied to Harvard only for the price match guarantee, kind of like Walmart, where if I got into Harvard, I'd bring that offer to Cornell and say, Cornell, match the offer. So I never took the Harvard application seriously, kind of had some fun on the application. I never knew they interviewed. So I get this random call from someone like 5 times in a row. I answered it like in a funny accent, thinking it was a telemarketer, which apparently it was Harvard calling to schedule my interview. Just everything that could go a little bit
quirky and wrong. Well, that's your thing. That's your thing. Okay.
Story of my life.
Story of your life. Yeah, really.
The interviewer, after I like teased her on the phone thinking she was a telemarketer, came down to my school in Cape Cod the next day to interview me. And we got along great. And she said, oh, who's your favorite author? I said, I love The Giver by Lois Lowry. She said, no way, Lois Lowry is my best friend. And just everything went exactly as I hoped.
Wow.
So through this weird process, and it was great because I applied to like 60 scholarships too. So I made a net profit off college, which is why I got to Storm Chase and travel and do all this
stuff. Wait. You made a net profit off college? How did you do this? What?
I applied for 60 scholarships, so I got like 100 grand, and if it was only about 8-9 per year to go.
And then they allow you to keep the extra?
So I didn't pocket it. I made sure to put it towards curricular activities, whether it be storm chasing, whether it be study abroad, whether it be traveling, donating some to the school such that they could use it to fund other financial aid or kind of cancel out mine. So I did everything the right way. But part of so I'll tell you about my major. But part of what I arranged with my special concentration was that storm chasing would count. So anyway, I wound up at Harvard. I knew immediately it wasn't the school for me. There was wicked imposter syndrome of being around all these like smart kids, and here's little old me who loves eating at the Waffle House, and who, you know, my favorite TV show is like Golden Girls. I didn't fit in there.
And did your parents go to Ivy League schools? I mean, or were you were the first, right? Okay, so, you know, you're at Harvard, you're at Yale. A lot of kids, you know, they're legacy kids. You know, they sort of, they grew up in that world. They know, okay, but you didn't, I guess.
No.
Okay.
I mean, there was no grooming. My parents are not fancy, wealthy people. I mean, we're regular people. And that's kind of why this whole world was a little bit daunting. Like, I never knew why there were two forks at dinner rather than just one. I'd never seen a salad fork before.
Love you. Oh, my God. Okay.
And so I go to the school, and immediately, like, I know it's not for me. The kids, my first impression was that they were very preppy, very aloof.
They want to be in finance. They're going to be doctors.
And historic. They just want to sound smart and historic or apropos all the time. And so like, week three of school, I have my first midterm exam. It's a physics exam. I didn't know it had been canceled. So like, I go to this building looking for this exam, and I go early. It's in the Jefferson Laboratories, which is a labyrinthic building. And it's in room like 212, which apparently is on the first floor next to like 318 below one. It's a weird building. So I spend 10 minutes looking, 15 minutes looking, 20 minutes looking. And I realize if I'm late to this exam, like, you get a zero. There's no makeup exam. This is not high school. There's no extra credit. So the time comes, 10 o'clock rolls around, and I'm late to this exam, 10:05, 10:10, and I'm toast. And I'm wandering through the hallways on the second floor, and I just kind of I give up. And I sat down the side of the corridor. No one was around, and just, you know, I started crying. And I look across the hallway, and I see a nameplate, and it says Eric J. Heller. And I think, wait a second, why does that sound familiar? And then I realized about 4 years prior, I've been writing for local newspapers on Cape Cod. And I wrote an article about the hurricane of 1938 that ravaged the Cape. And a guy named Eric Heller wrote in saying that it was the best article he read and this, that, and the other thing, and just singing me praise. And that had never happened before. So I knock on the door. It turns out to be the same exact guy who just happened to be an award-winning physicist and chemist at Harvard. And he and I hit it off immediately, became great friends, and he helped me create the first and only ever atmospheric sciences program for undergrads at Harvard. And this program was not supposed to happen to begin with. I take 7 classes per semester instead of just 4. I go to MIT 3 days a week. Some classes were just me in a classroom. I skipped a bunch of classes. I didn't take a single broadcasting or a writing course because I figured I can teach myself how to talk. I can teach myself how to write. I want atmospheric dynamics. And it was a very strange program, but it worked.
It worked. And from there, you and while at Harvard, right, you start writing for the Washington Post.
Yep.
And I'm assuming, you know, with you, it seems like it doesn't matter the institution. I think you put yourself out there. You probably did. You reach out to them. How did they find you?
So Jason Sabino from the Post, he's an incredible person and just one of the best mentors you can possibly have. And he reached out to me back at the end of my sophomore year and said, hey, you know, the weather at the Post, I've heard all about you. Would you ever be interested in perhaps writing an article for us? I said, sure. So I wrote an article the next week. And then that happened to be in 2017, where we had the total solar eclipse, hurricanes, Harvey, Irma, Maria, all these big storms. And so it became, instead of me writing once a month, I was writing 1-2 pieces every day. And it was good money. I had written for papers before where they had a $50 budget per week. And the Post, I mean, apparently they have money.
A lot more
so
budget,
yeah. $200 a day writing and just randomly writing while I was in class. So I didn't perform overly well in my atmospheric chemistry class because I was too busy writing. But hey, it set me up for a better future.
You're almost like a child actor here. I mean, where you're just like, you're making money everywhere you go. Now, did you have siblings? Do you have siblings?
I do. I have a younger sister, Emily, who is, how old am I? She's 20. She's 4 years younger than me.
Okay. And has it been hard to be the younger sibling to you? I mean, you seem like you've been probably a really good kid, you know, growing up. You obviously knew exactly what you wanted. And you've been making money since like the time you were 12 with this passion. I mean, how's your sister? Is she doing okay?
Oh, yeah. When I was 8 years old, 9 years old, I sold golf balls through a fence. We live next to a golf course, but we're not on the fancy side. We're on the not fancy side. So I'd sell golf balls.
It's okay if you're on the fancy side, by the way. I don't want to like money. I hope you're rich. I mean, I love rich people. So
I wish I was rich.
Okay.
My biggest goal when I reach a certain salary someday is to get a Dyson fan, because those things, they're bladeless. You can stick your arm right inside. Like, that's my biggest financial goal. And so if I
– You'll be there soon, I'm sure.
I hope so. We'll see.
You will.
Yeah, my sister is she's a good kid, my polar opposite in that, you know, big social butterfly in school. She had the iPhone back when she was, gosh, third grade, fourth grade, always Snapchatting, texting, all these things. And I wasn't a social butterfly. I'm finally in D.C. Like, this is the first time where I have a huge network of friends. I love it here. Like, D.C. is very much home. And yeah, my sister is the polar opposite. She's going to school to be a special education teacher. She's incredibly patient with kids, very good with kids. I think she'll be gifted at it. But yeah, good kid.
All right.
But definitely daunting for her.
Oh my God. Yeah. Yeah. I can imagine a lot to live up to. So tell me this, what's been your favorite, since you've been alive, what's been your favorite natural storm to cover, natural event? What's been the thing that like you were the most excited about when it comes to weather?
That's a really good question. And to be honest, it's not, for me, it's not just about the weather. It's who I get to share it with. And I love sharing things with people who would never otherwise get to see them. To witness a solar eclipse, to watch the moon block out the sun, and to stand in the moon's shadow while the universe is splayed out in front of you is otherworldly. Or to watch this entire sky spin, something the size of Mount Everest, sitting there floating and spinning, is unbelievable. And so to have been able to bring a few of my friends storm chasing, and these are kids who have no background in meteorology whatsoever, is amazing. A friend who, you know, my best friend went to Yale, and so we should be arch nemeses. But he moved to D.C. back in November of last year. And in March, I had casually said to him, hey, I'm going to see the Northern Lights in you know, around the equinox. Want to come? And he had a work remote job, and I was working remote at that point. He said, sure. So the two of us go up to Alaska.
Oh, my God.
We were both 23 at that point, so we couldn't rent a car. So we wound up renting a U-Haul van, driving around the Arctic in this two-wheel drive cargo van at minus 14 degrees in the middle of the night. I'm working on East Coast time, so I have to be up at 5 a.m. every morning and looking for the Northern Lights. We go to like senior citizen bingo in Fairbanks, Alaska at midnight one night. We do donuts in the Walmart parking lot. Like, I'm a professional, but I do not take myself professionally. And we had a blast. And this kid has come with me on all my trips, whether it be you know, storm chasing this year. I got to show him four tornadoes. I took him to, skydiving. Like, we have a pretty good time. So it's nice getting to show folks things that they would otherwise never get to see.
Okay. So seeing the Northern Lights was pretty magnificent.
I got to fly through them, believe it or not. So I had planned it that way, where I knew in March, we have something called the Russell McFerrin effect, meaning the Earth kind of has these cracks in its magnetic field.
Okay.
That allows energy from the sun to pour in and spark the Northern Lights. And what happens during that time of year, for only a couple of days, the magnetic field is really sensitive, really kind of finicky. And so I knew that if I planned a trip around then, and I had the American Airlines miles to do it, I might get to see something, weather permitting. And so we saw a couple meager displays in the Northern Lights. Alan went home because we couldn't get the same flights. But on the way back, I was set to take off from Fairbanks, Alaska, and connect to Seattle at 1 in the morning. I didn't have a seat assignment. Somehow I talked the lady, the check-in counter, into giving me the emergency exit row on the left north-facing side. And we took off into a Category 2 solar storm, meaning the Earth's magnetic field was on fire. And I got to fly beneath the Northern Lights. And, you know, you see the postcards, it just doesn't do it justice to see these vibrant colors pulsating, shimmering like wind chimes in the wind, going back and forth across the entire sky. And I know that our listeners might not be able to see, but just for your purposes,
yeah, I'll try to show you. Was everyone on the plane freaking out? I mean, what a beautiful sight.
Everyone on the plane was asleep, and it's kind of unfortunate. That's part of the reason why I want to write this book, Looking Up, because people miss
Look
these things
up.
all the time.
Oh my God, I know, this is the plight of your existence. Wow, this is from the airplane.
That's from the airplane.
Oh my
and,
God, beautiful
you know,
green.
I'm sitting here looking
like
out
this
the window
emerald green.
With tears coming down my face. It's so beautiful, like wishing I could share it with someone. And I have a lady who's had a couple of glasses of wine next to me who's like out, sprawled out, sleeping. And like, these people are missing an experience of a lifetime.
Matthew
but
Capucci.
It happens like that all the time.
Okay, Matthew, how do you think, do you worry about climate change? You know, you're so passionate about this. And here's another thing, right, where it's so hard to get people collectively involved in climate change. But, you know, obviously you report on the climate every day. What do you think it is? How can we get people to care?
Hand me the wallet. People will not care until a weather-related and climate-catalyzed disaster strikes them. People in New York City weren't thinking about climate change 2 years ago, I guarantee it. Yeah, they might have a couple hot days every summer, but they don't really care about it. But all of a sudden, when Ida's climate-catalyzed and climate-supercharged rains flooded the city and killed 42 people back on September 1st of this year, suddenly we get that climate conversation going. Same thing in most places. Until someone is actually impacted by something that hits them where it hurts, which is unfortunately either life, property, or their wallet, they won't care. And that's why when I communicate climate change, and I'll talk climate change 3-4 days a week on Fox. And I mean, management here is going to be a great platform to talk science as much as I want. But I don't communicate it the way that is conventionally communicated. If I get in the air and I say, oh, hey, we're warming a tenth of a degree Celsius every year, or if I get on there, or even every decade, or I say, hey, the seas are getting 2 millimeters a year higher, I can't measure 2 millimeters. If
right.
I put 2 millimeters in your swimming pool, you have no idea what that looks like.
Sure.
If I turn the thermostat in your room up a tenth of a degree, doesn't matter. But if I say to you, and let's say you're from Houston, I say, hey, you know, in Houston, the increase in temperature means the air can hold more water, which is translating to the equivalent of 49 extra days of precipitation every year and high-end flooding, suddenly you're thinking, wait a second, I had an insurance claim 2 years ago from high-end flooding. Maybe this is starting to be a real thing. And so it has to be communicated on a local level. It has to be communicated in a way that is personally relevant to people, because broad brushing something across the entire world doesn't matter. No one cares about polar bears. I love polar bears, but Joe Schmo in Walmart doesn't care about polar bears. He cares about how he's going to feed his family, how far his paycheck's going to go, and if he's going to have a tree fall on his house from a windstorm that wouldn't have been there 40 years ago.
And what do listeners and viewers write in and say? Do you think that they're taking notice, or do they write to you and they're like, Matthew, enough, like, we don't care?
It is overwhelmingly positive feedback. I'm shocked. Like, TV meteorologists are supposed to get hate mail. I don't get any. People are incredibly nice.
Famous last words. Oh, God.
Like, I'm genuinely shocked. I get probably 5 or 10 nice comments per day, which, you know, lifts me up. It's incredibly kind. But I think it's one of those things where if you treat viewers like the smart people that they are, I think so. People are so used to things being dumbed down on TV that I don't dumb things down. I bring the audience up. But I think if people think that you treat them with respect, and that if you're nice to people, which I am on all platforms, I just want to spread positivity. And with a little self-deprecating humor, trying to make people smile and laugh, I think it makes people lower their guards enough that they're willing to take in information that they might otherwise not consider.
All right, Matthew, this was very fascinating to me too. So you were telling me before the podcast that the weather, within the weather business, right, it can be very, very competitive. And you've actually experienced the most jealousy and the most backlash, not from the audience, but from other meteorologists.
Yeah, definitely. It's kind of funny. Broadcast meteorologists, we really stick together in that I've been going to the American Meteorological Society's conferences since I was 14 and presenting there. And so all the TV folks kind of know each other. And if they don't know me, they know of me, or they know someone who knows me. And honestly, over the years, because I've been going there since I was in high school, I've kind of become their mascot. So the TV folks are just incredibly nice people. Within academia, there are a number of people who look down on TV meteorologists because, let's face it, we're standing in front of simplified graphics. And so people think that just because we're not presenting to other scientifically minded people, not using the big crazy words or deriving the quasi-geostrophic equation, they think we don't know it. Whereas in reality, we almost have to know our stuff better because we have to take these big ideas and translate them down into bite-sized bits that the general public can understand. But that breeds a lot of almost animosity towards broadcasters, and me in particular. I have, you know, peers my own age who routinely bash me on Twitter or who have gone after me for years.
And what do they, What do they say? They don't like the way you report. They say it's inaccurate. What do they come after you for?
Everything, whether it be I'm not qualified to do what I'm doing, or I'm storm chasing in a bad way, or I'm oversimplifying something. I'm like, yes, I'm simplifying things. I'm not going to bring out the quasi-geostrophic Ertel potential vorticity equation or the vorticity tensor on air. And it's just amazing that there's unfortunately jealousy. And I think people forget that there are some sectors within meteorology with like the very online people where it's almost become a sport to bash me. It's like a snowball effect. One person will pile on, another will.
Well, that's our society wants to take down successful people. And you're successful. You know, you're successful at what you, and people don't like that. We see it all the time with various degrees of cancel culture. You know, people don't want you to get too big.
Like people even try to bash my degree. Like there are people who will spread rumors that I don't actually have an atmospheric sciences degree, or that my degree is fake, or just all these silly things. And it gets old. Like at first it's easy to laugh off, but when it's, I don't know, the good outweighs the bad. People in DC genuinely love me. My field, I'm respected within, but when there's, you know, 20% of the field is out to get you, or 20% of the field tells you all the time you're a bad meteorologist or you don't know your stuff, it hurts. And I know my stuff. I know I'm darn good at what I do, but it's the same people. And it's usually folks roughly my own age to like 30. It's that really? Window where, yeah.
I would have thought it would have been older meteorologists hating on the younger generation, like kind of being like, oh, you know, you're too positive or you're too, but it's your people your own age. Fascinating.
Yeah, it's very funny.
The jealousy, wow.
It's a weird thing, and I get some of it. Like, for example, there was an article I wrote a couple of years ago about the Nashville tornado and how there was this tornado in the middle of the night. It was an EF3 tornado, killed 5 people, lifted, then another one touched down from the same storm, killed 18 people. And it was an uncomfortable loss for the weather enterprise. People were not expecting the tornado, and this rotating thunderstorm had a history, a 3-hour history of dropping tornadoes, dropping baseball-sized hail, even a killer tornado. And then all the warnings were dropped as it moved into Nashville at about 1 o'clock in the morning, even though debris was visible and on radar. And the warning wasn't issued until after it had destroyed the John C. Toon Airport and was already in the process of claiming lives. And the next tornado had like, I don't know, 3 minutes warning or something silly like that. And I wrote an article about how the weather enterprise kind of failed. And that drew the ire of a lot of National Weather Service meteorologists who felt that I was bashing them. And in reality, I'm never in the business to bash. But when I'm beholden to the public. I'm not beholden to fellow meteorologists. I'm not beholden to, you know, corporate companies. I'm beholden to the people I serve. And that's the public. And for this, they wanted answers. And I had to give them answers, even if they were uncomfortable. And even if, you know, people were kind of asleep behind the wheel in these, you know, taxpayer funded entities issuing warnings. And I still get a lot of hate from that. And wow. It's unfortunate, but, you know,
weather wars. Damn, it is a heated business, Matthew.
I just try to be nice to people. And hopefully, yeah, in the long run, I think people only get ahead by being nice.
Do you think you ever see yourself in politics? You also seem like you'd be a great politician.
I'd love to be. I just know I'd be canceled.
For what? Do you have some controversial opinions you need to share here? Ooh, dish.
Let's see. I almost got canceled the other day for commenting on a Facebook post that I didn't like seafood. Apparently, if you're from Cape Cod, you don't like seafood. That's a no-no. I just think there's something fishy about it, but that's just me.
All right, tell me this. You know, a lot of people, you're one of the younger people at Fox. Are you married? Are you dating? I mean, how's that going? I mean, now you're a public figure. So that's going to be something else to navigate. Although I almost see you probably linking up with someone who's also in love with meteorology. Like, I don't know. I just see you as two meteorologists meeting.
I could never, because this is going to sound incredibly egoistical, but I don't want someone critiquing my forecast, and I do not want to bring work home. Unless I'm chief meteorologist, and it's well established that I'm chief meteorologist in the household, then I couldn't do it. But yeah, as for dating, you know, I tried Tinder for a while, and it turns out the people on there are not as wholesome as one would hope. But I just want someone to watch a meteor shower with.
So awesome. No, Matthew, they want to hook up with you. They do not want to have small talk about the Northern Lights. They want to see your Northern Lights, and that's it. You know, that's really it.
Well, they're not very radiant, but in any case, here I was posing this whole big wholesome message about, you know, I'd ideally like to find someone who I can watch meteor showers with and who's adventurous and who wants to go and travel and all this stuff. And the messages I got were not like that. So I asked that.
Oh my God. So, okay. So you're not on any dating websites now. You're open to finding somebody, but so far nothing.
So far, no. Yeah.
I love that you're already saving for your kids. I mean, how much money do you think you have saved for these? And how many kids do you want? I love this, that you're already planning.
I'd like at least three. You know, my grandfather was a person I looked up to most in life. He never won anything. He was, by every way, shape, and form, the most conventionally average person. He was living paycheck to paycheck his entire life. He never got an award, never got anything, but he was the best human being in the entire world, because even if he didn't have, I mean, heck, if he didn't have dirt, he'd still give it away. He'd do anything for anyone and was just the most humble person in the entire world. He had no college degree, neither did his wife. His wife was a lunch lady. He was an electrician. They put five kids through college and all their grandkids went to college. And, you know, back before he died, and I did this to all my grandparents and great-grandparents without anyone knowing, when I got my license, I went to all my elderly relatives' houses and I told them I was doing a school project and I needed them to say one nice thing about all their kids on camera and just kind of reminisce over their life. And once all these people pass away, I'd make DVDs for all their kids and give them out a couple of years later. And no one knew I did this until they get their DVD in the mail. But anyway, when I was asking these questions, I said, what's your biggest regret in life? And he said, you know, kids bring you more joy than anything. He said that having five kids was a monumental task, but if you could do it all again, he'd have five more. And I can't wait to have kids. I love them. I teach a ton. I've always worked with kids, and I can't wait to have, you know, a mini-me.
They're amazing. It is true. As someone who just had a kid, it's pretty amazing. Yeah, he's 7 months old.
Oh my gosh, congratulations.
So thank
What's his
you.
Name?
Kimball Jeffrey, but we call him KJ. Oh,
so I love that.
KJ is awesome. And yes, it is life-changing and they bring you so much joy. And it's nice. I mean, because this, I'm going to kind of ask you some rapid-fire questions. But sure. I did wonder this. I mean, your life has been pretty planned, right? And that's come true. At least that's the sound, right? Do you ever feel like, you know, this is a lot for you? I mean, it's a lot of pressure, I feel like. Do you feel like that or no? Like, are you in therapy, basically? Because, I mean, I have to imagine, you've done everything right. I mean, that's, I'm sure not everything. But, I mean, I think to people listening to this, it's like, you're so impressive, but that's a lot for somebody 24. Most people are at 24 are just beginning to perhaps find their passion. So, I mean, you've almost lived a lifetime when people haven't. So I'm wondering how you handle all that.
You know, I think I'm one of those people that this can sound so sad. I've never actually been proud of myself. It's like how I've never actually done a TV hit where I felt good about it. And yet,
wow.
I mean, I must be doing decently because they hired me and they keep me around, knock on wood, of course. But it's like there's never been something I've been fully 100% satisfied with my own performance. 97%, maybe 98%. Like this morning, I did well on my 5:15 weather hit. But I think no matter what I get to in life, I'll always be trying to up the ante to get a little bit more, to try to do a little bit better. It's like almost racing myself. I set these lofty and oftentimes unreasonable goals. Like I wanted to be in a top 10 TV market by 23. I didn't want to have to climb the ladder by going to Bismarck, Fargo, all these places, which are fine places, but I didn't want to do that. I want to come to DC, hit the ground running, and I knew I was good at what I did. I just needed to find someone who would give me a shot. And I mean, kudos to Paul and Kyle, who took a chance on really a big kid who happens to know weather. But yeah, my goals are still extreme. I want to publish a book by 24. I'll make it by, I think, 9 days, 10 days or something silly like that. I wanted to, and I still want to, I want to hit network news and be either national or have my own TV show by 28. And I'd like to hit all, I want to travel to every country in the world. And North Korea might be a tough one. I don't know if the visas work
Please,
well.
I don't think you should go there. No, no. I'm not sure they'll be receptive to your positivity, even if, I don't know. Okay, let's do some rapid fire. So what does get Matthew Cappucci down? I mean, you're pretty positive, but what does get to you?
This will sound kind of sad, but wondering if I made the right career choices in that all of my friends... And this will sound like I'm complaining. I love my job. That's the thing, though. I love it so much, but I know it's not going to last 10, 20 years. Like, just the way that TV weather is going. And so all my friends have these cushy corporate jobs where they might be making mid-100s at 24 and have these stock options and all this stuff. And, like, I'm doing fine now. I just know that I'll never have that sort of stability that they will. Just by nature of being in media. And I think everyone who's in media can kind of appreciate this, that we're always sort of up in the air. It takes a long time to become established and a longer time to really kind of grow a nest egg. And so I get sad sometimes thinking, maybe should I have kept weather like a side passion? But then again, I know if I went a single day without doing it, I'd be sad and miserable. Like, sure, all my friends might make a ton of money and make more than me and do whatever, but their jobs, I just don't see meaning in what they do the way that I see meaning in getting to go on air and share what I love with people every day or write and share what I love with people. And the number of comments, I've gotten thousands of comments from people saying, hey, you brighten my day. And even if it's something as simple as the email I got, for example, during the pandemic, there's a woman whose mother was undergoing cancer treatments and she said that the entire world kind of seemed to be against her. And she listened to my 45-second weather hits on WAMU and feel like she had a friend for 45 seconds, just a semblance of human connection. And if I can have just a little bit of an impact, that's all I want. So that's why I do what I do.
Okay, Matthew Cappucci, because you're just a person that I like to say both first and last name. It's just a good name. Name a food that you eat that's embarrassing, because you don't eat seafood. But I sort of see you having a bowl of Fruit Loops every day. What's the last?
I actually don't do cereal. It's... No,
Is there any foods that you eat that you should be embarrassed about eating, but you're not?
So I've been trying to lose weight. So I've been doing carrots every morning for breakfast, which carrots are boring. I'd much rather toast or sprouts.
Who eats carrots for breakfast?
Oh, I'm sitting there in the weather center, just crunch, crunch, which that's actually how I learned the first time that we have to turn off our microphones once we leave. I just thought our mics like turned off when we left the studio. So like I was eating carrots and then I went to use the restroom. Like right as I'm walking in, I hear, Matthew, can you shut your microphone? I'm like, oh, they've heard me crunching carrots all day long. So I learned.
Oh, my God.
I'm trying to think of a food that I...
No, that's embarrassing. You got it. Yeah. That was good. That was good. Okay.
I do tater tots and French onion soup, too, or tater tot pizza. But, yeah.
Tater tot pizza.
They serve it with a complimentary Lipitor.
Yeah, exactly. Who's your favorite meteorologist of all time?
We can't self-nominate, right?
Yeah, say yourself. My own work.
I love everybody for different reasons.
All right, like, but come on. Who was the person that you looked up? Like, I'm sure you practiced your meteorologist hits. As a former DJ myself, I mean, I would practice being Howard Stern. I mean, you must have... Who were you emulating? Who did you want to be?
There are a couple people. So Harvey Leonard's a guy who I always grew up watching in Massachusetts. I think he's like 72, 73 now. He's still the chief of Channel 5. And he had the same kind of calm delivery every single time. And for me, it wasn't even so much his style. It was just the fact that he was the one I always grew up watching. And it was nice for like a nerdy weather kid to be able to talk weather with a guy on TV for 3 minutes every day. It was the only time somebody else got to talk weather and have a platform doing it. And I met him at a conference when I was 14, and to this day, my legs still shake. Like, the night before I started the job here at Fox 5, he called me. We were talking for about a half hour. He was giving me advice, and even on the phone, my legs were shaking. And I'm still in awe of him. There's a guy, James Spann, who's at ABC 3340 in Alabama, in Huntsville, or Birmingham, rather. And his style is just such that he knows every single intersection, crossroad, everything in the state. And I think that's an important thing, too. Like, if I'm doing tornado coverage, people don't really know streets, roadways, counties. They know intersections in a restaurant. So I need to really beef up my knowledge of the DMV even more. But really, in terms of style, I don't think there's anyone who has a style like I do. And I think that I'm sure that gave pause to a lot of news directors out there in reviewing my tapes. But I firmly believe that the days of standing in front of a green screen doing weather in front of maps are done. If I can stand, like, why are we, we as in the field, why are we standing in front of something that the iPhone spits out? Why am I standing in front of a map that says 64? Those are just numbers. And so I'd rather be out in the field, seeing, doing, educating. Mm-hmm. I can point to a chance of tornadoes in a map, or I can be out there standing in front of that tornado in Annapolis showing folks. And that's why this is a podcast for the station, but sincerely, I'm beyond grateful to management for letting me kind of do what I want. And if I want to do an explainer on why fall smells a certain way, sure, do it. If I want to stand in front of the tornado in Annapolis and narrate, here's a tornado, I can do it. And so that's what weather needs to be. And that's my style. And that's a style that I hope takes me through my career.
Absolutely. Matthew, last question. When was the last time you were drunk?
What time is it? I'm kidding.
Do you drink?
So I do drink. I've tried to cut back. I never really drank in college. My first drink was when I was, believe it or not, so I had a couple of drinks in Israel when I was 19, but they were legal. I was there. My first U.S. drink was when I was on a Coast Guard ice cutter, or getting off a Coast Guard ice cutter. I turned 21 on August 13th, 2018, but I was on a Coast Guard ice cutter in the middle of the Arctic Ocean volunteering to help, like, count plankton or something. I had no idea what I was doing. I volunteered for the free trip to the Arctic. When I got back to shore, we had about 4 hours in Nome, Alaska, before the time we boarded the flight back to Anchorage and eventually Boston. And so the entire science party was buying me weather-themed drinks. So a dark and stormy, a tequila sunrise.
Oh, a hurricane. Oh, no.
Yeah.
The worst.
And it was fine. Like, it was a fun flight. I was getting the flight like,
the worst drink of all time.
No, I think I overdid it a bit on study abroad. Nothing but I'll tell this story. But I always worried that if I drank too much, it would get in the way of my career. And it never has, with the exception of one time when I was in Vietnam. And the program itself was crazy. That's a story for another day. But anyway, 9 of us rented a house for the weekend in a place called Fez. Where were we in Vietnam? I don't remember. Anyway, we were in a house in Vietnam. And it was Friday night, our time. So obviously, like, we were all having a nice time drinking and whatnot. And it was Friday morning, Eastern time. And I forgot that I had to write a Washington Post article. And we were 12 hours off. So we start drinking at like 5 p.m. That's 5 a.m. Eastern time. So by 6, 7 o'clock, I'm a couple beers in. And then one of my friends, and they're all playing a drinking game, whatever. I'm sitting there typing because that's what I do. One of them handed me some orange drink that smelled like hand sanitizer. And I was sipping that and whatever. And I had another one after that. And I'm writing an article about a major hurricane or typhoon set to slam Japan. Now, you know when you write what you hear?
Yes.
Apparently, we were talking about Olive Garden. And so I don't remember going to bed that night. The next morning, I woke up. I was in my pajamas. I had folded all my clothes, brushed my teeth, put my retainer in. I apparently had ironed my outfit for the next day. Like, when I'm intoxicated, I'm apparently very productive. But I woke up panicking, realizing I hadn't submitted my Washington Post article. So I go to open my email, and it turns out I had submitted my Washington Post article. And everything, for the most part, was fine, except where I meant to write, damaging winds and squalls will lash the main island of Japan beginning at 9 p.m. tonight. I had written, buttered pasta and bottomless breadsticks will slap the main island of Japan beginning at 9 p.m. tonight.
Which they should have printed.
And sent that to my editor, and thank God they didn't print it. Like, he caught it. He has no idea still about, like, he's probably going to watch this podcast and be like, oh, that explains it. But yeah, so since then I vowed to divorce drinking from my career. They do have me every so often doing these field trips where I'm having wine at like 9 a.m. But I mean, if Hoda and Kathy Lee can do it, so can I.
Absolutely. Matthew, it was a treat. Where can people find you and follow you? You have obviously a devout following anyway, but where can people see you and find out more?
So Facebook, Twitter, at Matthew Cappucci. Cappucci spelled like cappuccino without the no. My TikTok, I'm not nearly as good as Angie Goff, nor do I dance. But if you want wholesome weather content, there's that. And I'm trying to think what else.
And we catch you, what times on Fox 5? It sort of changes week to week, right?
It changes week to week. So as far as I know, beginning the new year, I will be on a little bit more regularly, switching around different time slots. But you never know when you'll catch me. I'm kind of like the weather. I'm here 1 minute, gone the next. But hopefully I stay here for a long time.
Matthew, this was awesome. Thank you so much. And I'm sure just people listening to this are going to be inspired by your enthusiasm. So that was awesome.
It's a pleasure. I'm grateful to you and everyone at Fox who makes stuff like this happen.
Let's go.